when you first started singing, and you said something about who's and who for best of something for such and such. I was reminded that I was a who's who person after college, and I can't remember what it was for. It was a who's who for such and such. Yeah, I don't think I left any kind of a long-standing legacy at Olivet, but people remembered me as I was graduating anyways. Go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. And as you do that, let me ask you a question. This is probably a question you've maybe asked yourself at some point, or somebody else asked and maybe had a conversation about it. But here's the question. What would you do if you were to win the lottery? Have you ever thought through the answer to that question when you hear, you know, on the news somebody wins, you know, multi-million dollars? And what would you do if you won $100 million or $200 million? What are you going to do with it? The kinds of answers I often hear verbalized in those kinds of conversations come into different categories. First, you know, pay off debts, buy a nice home for someone you love, travel the world. Some people say, I'm going to give most of it away. And others say, I'm going to save it. I'm going to live off the interest. I often watch I don't watch the NFL draft when that happens, but the NBA draft, I'll watch part of that. And you do have a lot of people. They come from maybe a poverty situation, maybe not. They're not coming from a lot of money. And then they get that first check, and they start talking about how that money is going to get spent, and they're going to buy their mom a big fancy house or a nice car. But almost every single time when people do the theoretical conversation about if I were to win millions of dollars, almost every time there is a huge emphasis put on how generous of a person they're going to be if they were to win such a large amount. Sure they're going to spend some of those winnings on themselves and their loved ones. Who wouldn't do that naturally? But they are, so they promise, they are absolutely going to be the most generous person possible with their winnings. And then you have the story of a man, Bud Post. Bud Post. His story is not unique when it comes to many lottery winners, not all of them, but a good number of them. Winners who win millions of dollars, but then they quickly find themselves struggling financially after winning that amount of money. So I'm going to read just a little bit of Bud Post's story. It's one of many of them, but this is the one I just selected. William Bud Post won $16.2 million. Pennsylvania Lottery, 1988. So $16 million back in the 80s. We're talking 30 years ago. But he was $1 million in debt within a year. Within a year, $1 million in debt. I wish it had never happened, he said. It was totally a nightmare. A former girlfriend successfully sued him for a third of his winnings, and his brother was arrested for allegedly hiring a hitman to kill him in the hopes that he would inherit the money his brother had won. And after sinking money into family businesses, Post sank into debt and spent time in jail for firing a gun over the head of a bill collector. I was much happier when I was broke, he said, according to the Washington Post, but lived quietly on $450 a month in food stamps until his death in 2006. So that's his story. I'm pretty sure when he bought that ticket, that was not what he had hoped for. I'm sure when he got the news that he had won the lottery, that also was not what he was hoping for. So now let's jump into Scripture, Luke chapter 12. Go ahead and stand with me as I read this morning. Luke chapter 12, I'm going to begin in verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. The word of the Lord this morning. Go ahead and have a seat. Before examining this parable, I want to clarify that when it comes to the adjectives of rich and fool, there are also the inverse adjectives of poor and wise. So taken together, those four adjectives create four different categories for people to fit into. And I say that as somebody that does not like categories or labels to pigeonhole people into, but for the most part, it's unhelpful. But this parable is about a rich fool. But a person can also be a poor fool. A person can be a rich, wise person or a poor, wise person. The point being, there are options here, and this particular story is about one of those categorical options. One should never, ever look at a person's wealth or lack of wealth and use that as a measure for determining their amount of wisdom or lack of wisdom. Assuming that someone is smart because they are rich is a flimsy assumption, and assuming someone is a fool because they are poor is an equally flimsy assumption. This parable helps us to avoid assumptions because it's a carefully crafted parable, a descriptive parable from the lips of Jesus. It's descriptive to the point that it even tells us the inner thoughts and the inner workings of the main character. We don't have to assume from the actions what's going on in the inside. Jesus tells us. And because we get a glimpse at the inner workings and the inner conversation of this person, we don't have to make uninformed assumptions about what's going on. And it's also a parable prefaced by squabbling siblings in regard to an inheritance and a warning by Jesus to be on your guard against all kinds of greed. And so we head into this parable that we just read, knowing full well what Jesus wants us to be looking for. The very first thing that we learn about this person in the parable is the fact that he is blessed. He is blessed by an abundant harvest, but he is not a poor person who receives an abundant harvest. He is not a poor person who is blessed by an abundant harvest. He is an already rich person who is taking in even more through another good crop. In verse 16, the ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. And so that makes him an already blessed person taking in another round of blessing. This guy isn't lucky, he's blessed. And there's a world of difference between being lucky and being blessed. Scripture says that he produced a good crop, and so it sounds to me like he had some sort of a role. He's not a business owner and everybody else is making the money. It sounds like he had a role in the production of a good crop. And so it's assumed that he has a role in his becoming rich. He's been active. He's been busy. It doesn't sound like he married into money or was born with a silver spoon in his mouth that he inherited. This guy, seeing a good crop coming in at the harvest, is not something that should be surprising. It's not some sort of a twist in his fortune. It's not a lottery ticket out of nowhere. He is blessed, and he has been blessed. Blessed to the point that he has a logistical problem on his hands, a very brief logistical problem in his mind. When the crop comes in that is too massive for his barns, it's not a problem where so much. It is not a problem where so much has come in that he doesn't know where to do it. Let's try this again. It's not so much a problem that he's got a large crop coming in. He's used to large crops coming in. The problem is he doesn't know what to do with it. Maybe you've had that kind of a problem before. I've had that problem with tomatoes and cucumbers with the garden. So many tomatoes coming in, I don't know what to do with it, and so I'm trying to force those things off on people. So many that I didn't know what to do with them, and so church and places like that, I was handing them off. And so there's an element of panic that people can have when too much comes in. But when it comes to this certain rich man, it doesn't seem like it's a panic moment. It's a moment where he realizes the problem and he immediately goes into plan mode. If it were me in that situation, it would be, what shall I do? ! Like freaking out. What am I supposed to do with this large abundant crop? I have no place to store my crops! ! This certain rich man goes decisively from his problem to his plan. He's going to build bigger barns, a place to store all of his grain and all of his goods. Emphasis on all and his. Remember, this isn't him telling someone else about the crop he produced. This is his internal monologue talking to himself about the crop, his crop. This is not him talking to God who pours out blessings about what to do with the blessing. And here's the second thing we learn about this certain rich man. He's blessed to the point of overflowing, and he has zero intentions of being a blessing. The plan he has in store for this blessing he has received is all about himself, and that's the problem. All of the crop, all of the blessing, all for him. The attitude he has toward the good crop flies in the face of so many things that we read in Scripture as a whole, and the Old Testament in particular. An Old Testament that has commands pertaining to things like a first fruits offering and the practice of gleaning. The first fruits offering being something that is a visible and tangible recognition of where blessings come from, and it's an expression of gratitude to the God who is the source of every blessing. It's an offering that is also mixed with hope because you give the first fruit offering when the first ripened harvest comes in. It's not before the whole harvest is in. It's right as it's beginning. And so you give an offering on the front end. It's offered in the confident hope that more blessing and an abundant harvest is still going to come in. So here's the thing. If you have the confident hope that there will be more than enough, only then can you find yourself giving God the first that comes in. If you take away that confident hope, and what ends up being offered to God in that situation is whatever's left, whatever's on the back end of the harvest. And many times what is left on the back end of a harvest is nothing. Everything is used up and nothing left as an offering. Nothing that says that God is the source of all blessing, and nothing that says thank you for all you have blessed me with. It's not a good predicament to be in, and yet it happens all the time. And then you have the Old Testament command regarding gleaning. A little bit over a year ago when we had our Wednesday night Bible study going through the book of Ruth, this was a part of our discussion. And I'm going to read from Ruth chapter 2, reading just a few verses. Ruth chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who is from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So here's the backstory for Ruth. A man from Bethlehem, the same Bethlehem where Jesus was born, he takes his wife Naomi and his two boys to another country, Moab, because of a famine. His two sons marry women from that country, and one of them is named Ruth. The dad and his sons die, leaving Naomi and Ruth as widows. Naomi returns to her homeland in the town of Bethlehem, while Ruth has to leave her homeland of Moab so she can stay with Naomi. And so here they are as widows in a very dire predicament with no land, no money, no male protection whatsoever, and they're arriving in Bethlehem at the time of the harvest. If they had arrived in the springtime, they could have found a way to get some seed, maybe get a little bit of land so they could plant something their own and harvest their own crop later, but it's not that time. It's springtime. Their path to survival is tied to the good graces of a man named Boaz, and whether or not he will abide by the Levitical law and allow them to glean from his fields, fields that neither Naomi or Ruth plowed or planted or watered. So I'm going to read from Leviticus chapter 9. There's two chapters actually where it mentions gleaning and talks about it in Leviticus chapter 19 and in 22. I'm going to read from Leviticus chapter 19, just verses 9 and 10. This is God's command to his people. "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen or blueberries, maybe. Maybe we have some people harvesting blueberries. Don't go back and pick up the dropped blueberries. Don't go back in the vineyard a second time to pick them up. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. Whereas the biblical practice of first fruits offering is about the vertical relationship we have with God, the giver of all blessings, the practice of gleaning has everything to do with the horizontal relationship we have with others, displayed in the way we manage the blessings we've received from God. And neither of these two elements are evident in the life of this certain rich fool. We have access to the inner conversation of the rich fool, and there are no praises lifted up to God for the blessing. We have access to the inner conversation of the rich fool, and there is no desire for anyone to glean anything from this blessing aside from himself. If only there were a way to perfectly capture the essence of this kind of guy. There you go. Now, some of you know what this picture is about. If you could help, what word comes to mind with this picture on the screen? Can I hear? Mine, right here. Mine. So for those of you who don't know, the movie Finding Nemo has these seagulls, and they're, when they appear, they see something, and their response is, mine. So if you're familiar with the movie, thank you for helping me with that. It's nice hearing mine. The seagulls in that movie can say only one thing, mine. Apparently, it's the only thing they know. Everything they see it as mine. So now imagine this certain rich farmer as he looks out over his fields and he starts filling up his barns. His problem at the core is the attitude of mine. He looks around his farm and he says, mine. The crops, the wagons, the barns, the blessing, mine. He has embraced full ownership over something which he has zero ownership. The stark reality brought to light at the end of the parable is the fact that this certain rich fool owns nothing. Nothing, not even his own breath, belongs to him, and he is left with nothing. Everything is taken, and what is to be made of all of those plans and preparations he had for his barn and the harvest? And not only does the attitude of mine create in him a false sense of ownership, it blinds him from the responsibility he has toward those in need. If he takes in all of the crop, if he harvests all the way to the edge of the field, if he combs over the field a second time to get every grape that has fallen, if he sees every bit of that harvest as his, then what is left for the poor, the widows, the orphans, and the foreigner? But all he can see is the harvest he falsely believes belongs to him, so he cannot see them, mine. But what happens when, with clearer vision, we see that nothing is truly mine and everything belongs to God? If that were to happen, if I were to surrender any sense of ownership to possessions, I would suppose that would make something like the gleaning process more of a joyful experience. Joyful because you get to see God's possessions being a blessing to those in need. If you look at a possession and you see it as belonging to God, it's easier to see that possession going toward others. But if you look at a possession and you see it as belonging to you, it will be difficult for you to be happy with that possession being anywhere other than your own barn. Releasing your grip on things perceived to be your possessions makes them more readily available to those in need. When it comes to a follower of Jesus, as it pertains to treasures on earth, we do not have any. Because nothing is ours, all is God's, and we are called to share those blessings from God with others. Let me just read just a short portion from our manual, because you can't get in trouble as a Nazarene pastor reading from your manual, right? So I'm just going to read just a brief part in here. This is in the Code of Christian Conduct portion. The Church of the Nazarene believes this new and holy way of life involves practices to be avoided and redemptive acts of love to be accomplished for the souls, minds, and bodies of our neighbors. One redemptive arena of love involves the special relationship Jesus had and commanded his disciples to have with the poor of this world. That his church ought to, first, keep itself simple and free from the emphasis on wealth and extravagance, and second, to give itself to the care, feeding, clothing, and shelter of the poor and marginalized. Throughout the Bible and in the life and example of Jesus, God identifies with and assists the poor, the oppressed, and those in society who cannot speak for themselves. In the same way, we too are called to identify with and to enter into solidarity with the poor. We hold that compassionate ministry to the poor includes acts of charity, as well as a struggle to provide opportunity, equality, and justice for the poor. We further believe the Christian's responsibility to the poor is an essential aspect of the life of every believer who seeks a faith that works through love. We believe Christian holiness to be inseparable from ministry to the poor, and that it drives the Christian beyond their own individual perfection and toward the creation of a more just and equitable society and world. Holiness, far from distancing believers from the desperate economic needs of people in this world, far from that, holiness motivates us to place our means in the service of alleviating such need and to adjust our wants in accordance with the needs of others. So here's the concern when it comes to preaching a message and reading a passage about a certain rich man with an abundant crop and filled up barns. It can be really, really easy to say, this doesn't pertain to me. I don't have a filled up barn. I've got a maxed out credit card. I don't have a surplus. I have a debt. I don't need a bigger barn. I need a bigger credit limit. This message isn't about me. I know those kinds of thoughts exist because I've had those kinds of thoughts and I've had those kinds of circumstances. But here's the deal. Those circumstances do not release Christians from the responsibility to be generous. And the fact that Christians are not released from the call to live generously means that Christians need to work diligently to get themselves in a position to be as generous as possible. Informed by Scripture, our manual statement believes holiness people are motivated to minister to the poor. Holiness motivates us to place our means in the service of alleviating such need and to adjust our wants in accordance with the needs of others. Adjust our wants in accordance with the needs of others. If what I want is to eat, drink, and be merry, Scripture would call me a fool, and the Nazarene manual would tell me I need to sacrifice those wants for the needs of others. And that's a calling extended to every single believer, not just wealthy believers. The financial advice we get from John Wesley is pretty simple. Work as hard as you can, save all you can, so that you can give all you can. What I would encourage any believer to do is to be generous where they are. You don't have to win the lottery or receive an inheritance or be free from debt before you can be a blessing to someone. So start where you are, but seek after the example of Jesus. This morning we celebrate communion and we remember the example of Jesus. We recognize Jesus as the greatest blessing ever given to this world. And because of that recognition and the gratitude we have for it, we are compelled to share that blessing with our family, with our friends, with our neighbors, with our enemies, and with our world. To receive Jesus, the greatest blessing ever, but not share Jesus, is in essence to say, mine. As if the only thing that matters is me and my personal relationship with Jesus. That is not what we remember when we gather together at the table. Up here, Jesus is shared, and Jesus shared everything. Nothing was held back. Nothing was left in storage. The barn was emptied. So this morning, if you recognize Jesus as the greatest blessing given directly from God to his people and would like to express thanks as we participate in communion, please come and gather with me up at the table.